Harvard professor and New Yorker writer Jill Lepore's new book, The Mansion of Happiness, asks the questions, how does life begin? What does it mean? What happens when we die? These questions have no answers, but each has a history. That past, Lepore argues, not only shapes our everyday lives, it determines the course of our politics. Again, the name of the new book is The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Jill Lepore to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
What brought you to this particular subject to look at this history of life and death?
Well, I think I probably kind of backed into it. It started a few years ago when I was playing the game of life with my kids. Do you ever play the Milton Bradley game of life?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, with the little cars and the pink and blue plastic people that you put in them and you ride around the highway of life. And I was playing the game, and it seemed to me really different than the game that I remember playing when I was a kid, which is often the case, I think, when you play with your kids. Things in your childhood seem slightly different, but if you ever investigate, it turns out they're not. Well, in this case, I went on eBay and I bought a copy of the original game, which came out in 1960, and it turns out it was really different. It was quite different, and I got kind of fascinated by what had changed. There were these sort of funny superficial differences, like in the original game, the cars were station wagons, and in the games that I was playing with my kids, the cars were minivans, you know, these kind of goofy superficial differences. But there were some other tinkerings as well that reflected changes in how people think about the life course. So in the more recent game, you could have a midlife crisis. You know, midlife as a stage of life, as a sort of a mid-20th century invention that didn't make it onto that original game board. And just as a historian, I became kind of fascinated by the way in which a game of life, the board game itself, was like a little time capsule that kind of contained within it a whole history of ideas about birth and life and death and the stages of life. And so I kind of went on this little quest looking for the antecedents to games of life. And it turns out games of life go way back. The first one in English dates to 1790, but there are many quite ancient games of life from cultures all over the world. And I got kind of fascinated by how our ideas about the shape of a life change.
Actually, you start off the book by, again, as a historian, looking at the life of Milton Bradley.
Yeah. So the game that I played as a kid that came out in 1960 was actually a centennial edition of a game that came out in 1860, which I had, of course, this had been lost on me as a child. And so I went into an archive and I found a copy of Milton Bradley's original game. I didn't know Milton Bradley was actually a guy. Like, I thought it was just a name. And, you know, you just don't, I don't know, I guess as a kid, everything, you know, the things you think as a kid. Anyway, he had designed this game as a very young man when he was 23 years old in 1860. He had dropped out of Harvard because his parents didn't have enough money for him to finish school. And he had kept a diary his whole life and had lived this quite rich and fascinating life. But the diary was lost. It was very difficult to find out anything about him. But I became kind of fascinated with the idea, with how he had come to invent what is really quite a different game than the centennial game, but quite different from the games that preceded it. He invented this game in 1860 called the checkered game of life. He played it on a checkerboard. And the goal of the game was to get a certain number of points to win. And the only way you could really do that was by landing on a square called Happy Old Age. So the game is actually a lot about happiness, but there's no money involved. But it's a lot about success, which is very different from its most earlier antecedent, which was a board game called The Mansion of Happiness, which was the most popular board game both in England and in the United States throughout the 19th century. And the whole point of that board game of life was to arrive at the Mansion of Happiness, which is heaven. So in the game of life, you know, that you can buy at Target today, the point is to earn the most money, right? Like to use this cash that you kind of acquire. But in the 19th century, the games were mostly about landing on enough squares that have virtues on them so that you could arrive at the mansion of happiness, so that you could gain eternal salvation. They were all religious. So one of the things that the Milton Bradley game from 1860 really represents is a kind of secularization, a kind of big turning point in the secularization of our notions of life and death.
And it's fascinating because they're really taking a rather playful look at these huge questions of how does life begin and what does it mean and ultimately what happens when you're dead.
Well, I'm kind of fascinated by the huge philosophical questions, but I wanted to write a book that could engage people who would need to maybe, who would enjoy engaging with those questions through pretty concrete and fairly ordinary experiences and fairly ordinary stories. I mean, most people have in their house a board game and have some idea of what a board game is. And there turns out there's a lot you can do with looking at just every small little feature of a board game and what it contains and what it tells us. It's not delivered as, you know, it's not Nietzsche. I mean, the people that design these board games, they're just, you know, they're trying to sell a game. But what they do in order to do that is they reflect back at the culture what values the culture has, because they want to try to pander to what the prevailing values are. One of the cool things about the Game of Life in the 1990s, there was a lot of criticism of it because it's so cash conscious, and Hasbro introduced these things called life tiles, where if you do something good, morally good in the world, it improves your outcome in the game. But the only way, because the game is only about money, and that's really how it was always designed, the only way to be rewarded for doing something good is to get money. So, for instance, if you find a solution to pollution, you earn $250,000, which is not why you would want to solve an environmental problem. But you can see the game designers trying to think, okay, people are concerned about the environment. How can we put that into our game? You know, so they turn out to be really these little tiny packages of history.
When you were writing the book, how much of a different vantage point did you want to offer the reader on these arguments that we have had over the course of our existence as a country? Really, of life, liberty, and happiness.
Well, what I wanted to do was historicize some of what are the more nettlesome kinds of conversations that I think sees a political conversation today, and those, the conversations about abortion, about contraception, and about the right to die, these sort of so-called culture of life issues that I think we often, because of the nature of our political conversations, almost kind of buy into the notion that these are kind of timeless conversations that we've been having forever, and that the set of values that people have about these notions are eternal. And it's not that there's not great depth and passion and commitment on the part of people who hold a variety of different positions on these issues, but they actually do have a past. In the case of, for instance, the right to die as a political issue, or abortion as a political issue, especially these issues as partisan issues, not just issues that enter the political sphere and are part of our political conversation, but that seem to fall one way or another along a party divide, that is very recent history. That happens in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And it's not just about Roe versus Wade. It's about a series of other developments that kind of all work together and have gotten us to this place where we have this. Unfortunately, most of those issues don't just have two sides, right? I think most people would say there really aren't just two positions about these issues. Right? If you've ever been in an ICU with somebody who's dying, I don't think it feels to most people like there are only two choices.
Right.
There are many choices, and they're all painful and difficult, and they're all horrible, frankly. But we have a political culture in which there are only two parties. So how that kind of works out is people sort of force it to imagine that there are only two sides to these issues. And I think that's really a problem for how we talk about some very difficult and important issues. So really what I wanted to do in the book was not polemicize, because everybody else is polemicizing. It's not helpful. But to historicize.
And in that process, though, it is fascinating because, as you say, of just looking over the right to life, this is something that has, late 60s, early 70s, as you mentioned, 1971, but Roe versus Wade. However, you look at the fact that this is a very complicated issue that has now been, in so many corners, reduced to partisan politics. And you write about the troublesome nature of that, because it has been reduced to that, hasn't it?
It has, and you can kind of track it out. And other scholars have done this work, and I'm leaning on their incredible research in archives and the Library of Congress and in presidential libraries. But you can really track out and see how abortion as a partisan issue really doesn't fully develop until late into the 1980s. In the 1960s. The liberalization of abortion laws is led by doctors and clergy, and it doesn't have any partisan affiliation whatsoever. To the extent that it does, it's more Republican than Democrat. Planned Parenthood as an institution is more Republican than Democrat at that point in American history. And then there's a kind of party realignment during the Nixon years, when the idea to kind of bring Catholics from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party leads to conversations about whether this is an issue that would be able to do that. And there, you know, these memos exchanged in the Nixon White House about how Nixon should maybe reverse his position. Nixon had taken a position in favor of the liberalization of abortion laws. He reverses his position. And there's this kind of fairly calculated set of steps by which party leadership decides to make this a partisan issue because it's going to be very effective at dividing the Democrats. And but for decades throughout the 1970s and into the 1980s, even members of Congress don't vote along party lines on these issues. That doesn't happen until the 1980s, and the American public doesn't really consider these or in any predictable way vote along these issues on party lines until the 1990s. It's much more recent than we think. I mean, I guess like it feels a little bit like the Cold War, like when you were in when I was a kid growing up in the Cold War, it seemed like the Cold War had been going on forever and it couldn't possibly ever end, and no one could really imagine how it ended, and a lot of people kind of couldn't almost really remember how it began. That's a little bit like where we are kind of in this stuck and painful position over some of these life and death issues in American politics. It does have a beginning, which means that it will have an end.
Jill Lepore joins us. She is the author of the new book, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, which is published by Knopf. It is also fascinating because as you address these issues of life and death, in the book you also make the differentiation about, and this is really one of the themes that emerges, that the distinction of those questions, of the ideas of life and death, are different between the rich and the poor.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you can track through American history is how different conversations are had, especially during and after the Industrial Revolution, which increases the distance between the rich and the poor, about how to deal with policy questions involving family size. Because the big change demographically between 1800 and 2000, say, what's known as the demographic transition, is a lengthening of the lifespan, but also declining fertility rates. But that change, that demographic transition, happens first among the wealthy and kind of proceeds downward along the economic scale. And so a lot of policy conversations that we think about, say, during the Progressive Era, when Margaret Sanger is working on making contraception legal, for instance, are conversations about family size, but they're conversations that are had largely by wealthier people about poorer people.
When you look at the, because it also has to do with the stages of life, right? Of where you are from young to old, of where that becomes visible. And then in rich and poor and life and death, obviously it's different for an infant than it would be for a senior citizen.
Right, right. Well, one of the things I was actually fascinated by when I worked on the life of the actual man, Milton Bradley, we were talking about, he actually was a person, was, you know, so he designed this game of life in 1860 when he was a very young man and founded a company, the Milton Bradley Company, that produced games and all different kinds of game boards and croquet and all just kind of toys and playthings, and made a great deal of money very quickly. And when he had designed that game, there's a square on the board at the checker game of life for poverty. And the rules of the game are very explicit about this. And they say poverty is right near infancy. And the point that Bradley says, you know, poverty in infancy isn't really a disadvantage because we Americans, you know, we can rise above that. And this is kind of one of the great, you know, like American notions of the 19th century, kind of rags to riches. And Bradley himself had risen out of relative poverty into great affluence and earned a great fortune. And but later in his life, Bradley really came to regret that. And he is in some quarters best known for his role in the kindergarten movement, which was essentially a political and social reform of the late 19th century, response to the growing gap between the rich and the poor as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution, where reformers said, let's have free kindergartens for very young children. It's sort of like an earlier version of what we now call Head Start. We'll have these free schools for 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds, and it'll make it possible for them to rise out of poverty so that they don't go through life recapitulating the lives of their parents and enduring the entirety of their lifespan in poverty. And Milton Bradley was obsessed with this. He founded a journal for kindergarten teachers. He began producing art and craft supplies for kindergarten classrooms, publishing books about kindergarten. And this is the work in his life that he was most proud of. So there's this kind of beautiful almost redemptive quality to his commitment after being this kind of great prophet of success and the rise to wealth, with a kind of very grasping kind of game that he invents in 1860 as a leading proponent of the kindergarten movement.
One of the things at the point of which I fell in love with this book was you writing about Stuart Little, which is one of my favorite books. And you write you write quite a bit about E.B. White, another one of my favorites. It's a fascinating story. And just give listeners an idea of how the book Stuart Little fits into what you are saying about life and death.
Stuart Little was published in 1945, and when it came, if you'll recall, it's the story of a mouse named Stuart who is born to a woman named Mrs. Frederick C. Little and grows up with the Little family in New York City and goes on various wonderful, whimsical adventures. And when it was published, it was banned by the New York Public Library by the founding librarian of the children's room at the New York Public Library, who's a woman named Ann Carroll Moore. When I found this out, I was kind of scandalized. Like, what about Stuart Little? It's so controversial.
It was shocking, yes. Yeah.
So, and I come across it in a bunch of books I was reading about children's literature and the history of children's literature, which is of great relevance to the book because it's sort of about the invention of childhood. Like, children's literature has a history. There didn't used to be books that were aimed just for children, right? Like, it's a marketing category that's invented and then has blossomed. I mean, it's a huge market, probably the biggest part of the publishing industry today. Children's books that were specifically for children have a very particular history. In any case, I had come across this remarks about this little set-to between E.B. White and Ann Carroll Moore, the librarian, over Stuart Little in these, you know, various histories of children's literature, and everyone just kind of glosses past it, like, wait, no, I have 1,000 questions about that. How? Why? So I went into the archives and I read E.B. White's letters and the letters of his wife, Catherine White, who was an editor, fiction editor at The New Yorker, a very powerful woman, and Ann Carroll Moore and other of her colleagues at the New York Public Library, and I read all about the history of children's libraries. And the story really is about, it's about two things. For one thing, what scandalized Ann Carroll Moore about the book was the way in which the book called attention to the facts of life. That a woman could give birth to a mouse would make a child think about where babies come from, and children weren't supposed to think about that. So the book was, in her view, the product of a sick mind, she wrote in a letter, allegedly wrote in a letter to E.B. White. And this gives this kind of monstrous grotesqueness to it, and that was inappropriate for children. But also, really, the book for White came out of a lot of thinking he had been doing about the relationship between childhood and adulthood for all kinds of reasons, partly because he was mainly an author of work for adults. He was a writer for The New Yorker and a humorist and an essayist and, you know, the most celebrated essayist of the 20th century. Stuart Little was the first book he wrote for children, and it was marketed by Harper's as a book as much for adults as for children because it really, it's hard to imagine now, but it really did kind of read as a satire of a lot of progressive era children's sex manuals. It has a kind of whole other meta commentary going on that, I mean, it really is a delightful children's book, but it is in conversation with a lot of other things that White was writing about at the time. He had written this hilarious parody in 1938 for The New Yorker called The Birth of an Adult, which was a parody of a picture essay in Life magazine called The Birth of a Baby. It was a big scandal in 1938 when Life decided to publish this centerfold with these pictures of a baby being born, which the issue was then banned across on newsstands across the country, which is exactly what Life wanted because then it sold a gazillion copies of this. And, you know, they're just much stricter rules about obscenity in the 1930s. White wrote this hilarious parody called The Birth of an Adult, which was about how juvenile the whole controversy over the birth of a baby was. And that's the time at which he was writing Stuart Little. So there is there's a kind of surprising tie into a larger conversation about the relationship between children and adults and between childhood and adulthood and what's appropriate for children and what's appropriate for adults.
You have a great conversation between Harold Ross and E.B. White in the book where Harold Ross says, "Saw your book, White. You made one serious mistake. What was that? I asked. Why the mouse?" he shouted. "You said he was born. God damn it, White, you should have had him adopted. That's priceless.
It's priceless. It's pretty great. In later editions, White actually did have him arrive. If you buy the book today, the copy you might have in your house, he arrives. He's not born, he arrives. So all the edginess is I mean, if you think about the films, right, that most,
right.
Is maybe where, how a lot of kids encounter the book now. It doesn't work as parody.
Ultimately, when it's all said and done, what do you hope people take from this story of life and death?
Well, I guess just the notion that some of the ideas that we think might be timeless do, in fact, have histories, and that maybe we ought to be more open to hearing where other people get their ideas and have a more broad-minded conversation about it. I guess that would be, that seems like a didactic goal. I mean, really, the book is meant to mainly be a fun read.
Entertaining, and indeed it is. The name of the book is The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. It is published by Knopf. Jill Lepore, great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.